Hi, this is Bill Bolger from IndieTickets.com, and you're listening to First Crack with Garrett Von Gary.
All right, so welcome to the Tuesday, December 14th episode of First Crack. I'm here at the 101 Bike Studio with Gene Oberpiller. And is that right?
Gene Oberpiller.
Oberpiller, O-B-E-R-P-I-L-L-E-R.
Priller, like Priller. In Miller.
Like in Miller.
But I don't drink Miller. No beers from Wisconsin.
We're here at your shop, the 101 Bike Studio. / Go Coffee, which is one of my favorite places in Minneapolis, because it's got the bike shop, it's got the cafe, it's got the wireless, so I can spend a good chunk of time here, and I thank you for that.
Oh, and the junkyard.
I do want to talk about the junkyard while I have you today.
Okay.
So before we got started, you were saying this has been a 10-year plus project.
Yeah, I'd say since I moved into the building, 1990. And I think we got the ball rolling like the day we moved in because we had all this space to play with.
So all this space.
Well, originally when we lived on the second floor, uh-huh. It was just a big empty room with two bedrooms on each end.
Okay.
So we had all this room to put the bicycles.
Oh, all right.
And all we were doing was subplanting, if that's the right word, all the musicians that used to live here.
Okay.
And before the musicians were all the artists.
Right.
Because the artists were the first people to move in mm-hmm. in the 70s. And then in the 80s, the musicians started living with the artists.
Uh-huh.
And we moved in the 90s.
All right.
And we kind of took over at that point.
You've been slowly taking over the entire building since then.
Yeah. Yeah, we got rid of the last artist 3 years ago. But okay. Now something new has happened, and now we're being somewhat replaced by the web developers. So, which is fine, because, you know, it's just an evolution.
Right. Yeah. It's sort of the same vibe. Same sort of
yeah.
Creative.
Well, yeah, everybody who's been here is creative. All those entities have always had a creative energy, and this was always a great outlet to do it in because of, you know, you're downtown, you're in a warehouse district.
Yeah.
Traditionally, warehouse districts have traditionally always been like the epicenter of culture in the cities.
Right.
Because those are the first places you can live in a city, and they're really cheap.
Exactly.
Not so today. You can still find them, but it's getting tough.
Yeah.
And San Francisco, as some people know, has had a thriving art scene, and then they all got shoved out.
Uh-huh.
Then the dot-com bust happened, or boom, bust.
Yeah.
Now I know people who lived there then are moving back in because
rent is cheaper now.
Yeah, and I don't know if we'll see that here, but it might take a lifetime. But
yeah,
we're on the map now.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
in those 10 years, you, or even in not even 10 years, but just in a few months, you had a huge transformation of the space.
Yes. As some people know, there was a massage parlor here, the infamous Yoshiko's. Sauna, which was here for 27 years, and when we moved in, it was probably the beginning of the downward spiral, because in the 70s when it first opened, it was a pretty classic place.
Okay.
And then when we did the gutting of the building starting April of a year ago, we, going through the layers of things here, we came up with, oh, look at this. Look at the wallpaper here. It was like flocked red mirrored, or velvet flocked red mirrored wallpaper. It was really cool looking. And same with the carpet, same with the tile. I was doing some scraping of the paint and came across some unique colors. And so it's pretty interesting history. And of course the state finally stepped in after the city and the county couldn't make it. Couldn't make any charges stick, per se. So I got the phone call at like 2:30 in the morning. Gene, come down here. I close the door now. And I'm like, meaning? She's like, no, I'm done. And I'm like, all right, I'll be right down. And sure enough, she threw me the keys and walked away. And
wow.
I called the building owner the next morning and said, okay,
right,
are you ready? And she says, it's all yours.
Nice.
Go to it. So we spent, well, like three months gutting it. Then another probably 4 months, like, slowly but surely building it out.
Yeah. We tried coffee bar for a while, and then...
Well, we actually started...
Being it, yeah.
Yeah, the unique thing is we started from the back of the building in the alley and worked our way towards the front. So the bike shop was actually in operation 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And then when the sauna left, we just pushed the gallery out, because that was the next phase. And then the coffee shop was the last thing to get done, because we had to use the money we made from the bike shop to fund the gallery. And then when the gallery got done, we used the monies from the gallery and the bike shop to pay for the build out for the coffee shop, because that was the biggest nut we had to crack in order to make it happen.
Right.
So we're pretty much there. And then the junkyard, since that was always there.
Always been there. I was wondering, because I've been down there a couple times, and that just, you know, that quantity just doesn't appear overnight. You got to work at it.
Yeah, and my good friend, the Satanic Mechanic, was the one who instigated this. He's a freelance auto mechanic and a BSA motorcycle mechanic, and he's an ace Harley wheel builder. And he loves bugs.
Okay.
And he loves to drink good German beer, so... We would spend countless days, nights, mornings perusing the back alleys of Minneapolis.
Really? Just collecting stuff?
Collecting junk bikes.
Wow.
We'd make the occasional run once a month to the Salvation Army to buy bikes. Mm-hmm. Not so much anymore, because that's a really tough... It's tough now because word's out. You can get really cheap bikes to the Salvation Army.
Right.
By all means, go do it, because you can't beat that. So... In 90, we pretty much, the owner said we could have use of the basement.
Okay.
So I struck a deal with the sauna to get access to the back door, and we started filling the basement up. Because the Satanic Mechanic, since he's got a junkyard pedigree, as I like to say, we knew that, well, okay, you got automobile junkyards, motorcycle junkyards, appliance junkyards.
Right.
You know, there's a junkyard for everything, but we had never... really seen a bike one.
Mm-hmm.
5 years ago, I found one in Wisconsin. It was outdoors. I said, okay, we'll do an indoor one.
Yeah.
And I kind of got also the idea from a place called Drag Specialties, which is a huge motorcycle parts distributor now. But back in the day when they were in Lake and Lindale, they had a Triumph or a British motorcycle junkyard in the basement of their shop.
Oh.
And we kind of... You know, in wintertime, Minnesota, you know,
right.
It makes more sense to have an indoor one than an outdoor one.
Yeah.
So we just kept filling it up. And then we hit like a critical mass last year when it was like, there's so much stuff in here that we have to do something.
Yes.
So we did start it. We started a very aggressive recycling process. And that keeps us in beer money, because there's many scrap yards a few blocks from here. So we can take the real junk, the bicycle junk, the scrap, mostly the department store stuff, and we'll strip off what we know is going to work, and the rest goes to the scrap yard. And because, you know, you have your aluminum, your steel. If only bikes were made out of copper, we'd all be rich, because copper's got the highest recycling value, but aluminum's pretty good. So that also helped, like, fund the motivation aspect of it. And so the Satanic Mechanic and I got the junkyard going, not as a retail business, but just as a hobby, more or less. And then as I got the bike shop running in the back, it was more and more people looking for used parts, because they didn't want to buy new parts, especially new parts that weren't compatible with their old bikes. And there's enough old bikes out there that this all made sense. So it just kind of all melded together, and like, well, yeah, we don't need to be a new bike dealer only like everybody else.
Yeah.
And there's a few other places around the country doing that, like Revolution Cycles in Madison they're a reseller of used bikes.
Okay.
And Momo Velo in San Francisco is another one. Actually, that's Berkeley. and I know there's a fair number of other ones around the country. So what we're doing is nothing new. It's just new to this part of the country.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, why not? As what's his name, Dick Enrico from Second Wind Sports, I knew when second best reviews will do, something like that.
Yeah.
My dad gave me that idea. And I think it's been good for us. It's good for everybody involved.
Mm-hmm. Stuff still being added to the junkyard?
Oh yeah. Huh. Yeah. We don't do as much alleys as we used to because this is the full-time gig now.
Right.
I mean, we're still out there. I'd say we're still bringing in on average about 2 to 3 bikes a week.
Huh.
Some weekends we'll do half a dozen. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while I'll get a call from somebody who says, my father died, or my grandfather died, or my uncle died, and he's got this garage full of bikes. Do you want them, or do you want to buy them? And then we go and look, and we're like, oh, yeah. So we also have a collection of dead bike guy stuff. Because in the 60s and 70s, it was really prevalent, because that was when the last bike boom was, especially in the 70s, was a lot of people had the neighborhood bike guy.
Right.
He ran a shop out of his garage.
Uh-huh.
Well, as that generation dies off, that stuff's left behind.
Yeah.
And, so we bought some of it's been donated. We're trying to give some of those back to the community. Because dead bike guy stuff is the real good find. That's like, it's that show on Channel 2, Antiques Roadshow.
Right.
I found this thing. And it's like, oh, dude, this is like a really classic part from the 60s. And, it's worth hundreds of dollars.
That was one of the neat things I saw, and maybe it was maybe a year ago, when you had a lot more used bikes. There was definitely a history and a story with all of the used ones that you had.
Yeah, it's because you look at it and it's like, well, a used bike has got a story. There's a story behind it. Somebody owned it besides us at one point. And I had bikes come in that the original owner is in with it, or this person came in and they said they found it on the street. We don't know where it came from.
Right.
Or it'll have a bike shop sticker from Peoria, Illinois or something, and they don't know how it got here. We don't know how it got here.
Uh-huh.
So it's always kind of interesting to find out what the story is behind some of the bikes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the unique thing about it. It's always fun to have that fresh meat come in that you're like, oh, okay, what's going on with this one?
Uh-huh.
And sometimes the person is just as interesting as the bike, to say the least.
Uh-huh. Tell me the story of the rallies.
Oh, the rallies. That is, and that's nothing new by any means.
Right.
But before automobiles, it was all bikes. The roads originally were built for bicycles.
Okay.
So in the late 1800s, mm-hmm. before automobiles became as prevalent as they are now, everybody got around by bike.
Yeah.
So there was that period between horses mm-hmm. and automobiles where it was all bicycles all the time. And, well, if you think about it now, on a weekend or weekend night, you'll see like those hordes of motorcycle riders ripping around, or if you go up north, there's hordes of snowmobilers.
Right.
Or there's, people meet in parking lots with all their cars.
Right.
It was the same thing with bicycles.
Okay.
Just, it might have been a little more laid back. We don't know because all those people are dead, but I can imagine there was plenty of mm-hmm. bicycle rallies going on at that time in history. So basically, we were just kind of reviving it by today's standards.
Mm-hmm.
There's, in some cases, there's a fair amount of drinking and carousing and all that going on because it's far easier to get away with drunk riding than it is with drunk driving.
Yes.
So we're not advocating that, but a lot more people, I would say, I don't know if a lot more people do it than people who drive, but let's just say it's probably a lot safer.
Yes.
And granted, I've been stopped a few times for rowdy bike riding, and it was more about my rowdiness than it was about my drunkenness. So it's like, and if it would have been in a car or motorcycle, I would have lost my license a long time ago.
Right.
So there's, and like I said, we don't advocate it, but it's part of society.
Yeah.
And there shouldn't be really anything wrong with it. It's pretty harmless.
Mm-hmm.
you're not out there driving a two-ton vehicle around,
right?
Creating death and destruction. There's a reason why there's 40,000 automobile deaths a year and only maybe 100 bicycle deaths a year. So the rally thing is, it's just all about, it's no different than any other user group getting together. It's just, we're a little more loose. Some of that dates back to World War II, when veterans came back and they started riding motorcycles, the whole Hell's Angels thing in Hollister, California. There's a little of that action there because there's a lot of games going on. Because the original Hell's Angels out of Hollister, that's what they did. They'd have a motorcycle rally and they'd have like, the passenger would have to eat the hot dog hanging from the string on the stick while they're riding around in a circle or something like that. And, you know, we do variations of things like that.
And you had the coaster brake skid contest.
Yeah,
and
you can have coaster brake skid contests. You can have how many people can get on the bike and make it move. And I think the record down here is like 6 people.
Okay.
And there's a picture of it, which
the crappy bike race. That was one of my favorites.
Yeah, we'll have like the 20 or 16 inch wheel Grand Prix, which is really kind of, relay races are always fun. The skidding contest, like with a cafeteria tray, are always kind of interesting. These can go all winter.
Okay, I was wondering about that. I know you guys have the regular Wednesday night rides.
Yep, Wednesday night rides. We're not the Wednesday night. We just go on it.
Oh, okay.
That's a totally separate group.
Oh, there's
it's not a separate group.
There's an officially sanctioned, like, organized Wednesday night ride, and then there's you guys.
No, this Wednesday night ride is actually it was a group of Quality Bicycle Products employees.
Okay.
Who no longer work there, but they would meet at the Lake Harriet Bandshell and ride every Wednesday at 7. That was 8 years ago.
Okay.
It's now morphed into, now it meets at 10 p.m.
Oh, wow.
It turns into the Thursday morning ride. But, you know, and it's a different bar after the ride every Wednesday. We've nailed probably 80% of the bars in Minneapolis and a handful in the surrounding cities. We're still plugging away at it because some nights we go to the same bar, which we've been to 20 times.
Yeah.
But it all depends on people's motivation.
Right.
And but Wednesday night is that predates everything we've been doing by a while because it's mostly an off-road ride or run what you've run.
Right.
And the rallies kind of spun off of that.
Oh, okay.
Because it was like, hey, here we are riding Wednesday night. Well, maybe let's get together on Saturday and do something.
Right.
So you have things like the Homie Fall Fest, the first, or is it the third annual, fifth annual, or the second annual, fourth annual Pig Roast Derby. That's on Boom Island.
Okay.
There's the Formula Ice Race GP at Cedar or Calhoun or Isles or Brownie Lake, depending on where the promoter decides to put it.
Right.
And
I had heard that you started the rallies on the second floor.
Well, we've had rallies start from there. And we started doing swap meets up there.
Okay.
And the swap meets eventually turned into a rally.
Okay.
So you have the swap meet, and then that's when we started having like the little GP races. Mm-hmm. And then we had some bands show up.
Oh.
So now it's kind of turned into, it's a full-fledged rally. It's just, we have a swap meet also.
Right.
So, and that's like non-commercial. We don't promote the shop through it or anything like that, because I kind of like to keep those things separate.
Yeah.
One, for liability reasons, as I found out. And those dreaded liabilities.
Yeah. Those are
tort reform.
Every, 6 months or so?
Yeah. Well, we have the spring swap meet in May, and that's usually right around the 15th.
Okay.
May is National Bike to Work Week or National Bike Month.
Okay.
And then like the 15th, 16th, 17th is usually one of the National Bike to Work days.
Great.
Or work week. So we kind of all coincide with that. Plus it's springtime.
Yeah.
And then we have another one in end of August or as late as 1st of November.
Right.
And then that kind of like brings the season to a close, or brings in the next season.
Yeah.
Because we're at this point now where cycling seems to be, there's really no time to stop. We just go 24/7 all the time.
Yeah,
the weather really doesn't impede use anymore.
Missed more days this summer on the bike than I did last winter. So.
and again, it dates back. It's like, okay, what did they ride all winter here in Minneapolis in 1901? They must have.
Right.
I haven't been able to really find a lot of archives about it, but I've seen pictures.
Yeah.
So it's like, they must have been.
Must have.
People just didn't quit. If they were riding their horses or walking, I'm sure they were riding all the time. And so basically, and it kind of is like, it's full circle.
Oh, yeah.
Everything goes in full circles, and we're seeing that more in the bicycle industry as a whole. It's messengers ride fixed gear bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Fixed gear bikes were the first kind of bikes that were ever. The Tour de France was won on a fixed gear bike, and you know, and it probably weighed 30 pounds. And you know, now you can buy a 28 speed, 14 pound bicycle.
Right.
And that wins the Tour de France. So
yeah,
a lot of people think technology is the way to go, but not necessarily.
Right. Speaking of the Tour de France, you have some excellent photos up in the gallery space.
Yeah, this is our seventh exhibit.
Okay.
And it's our, I don't want to say it's our best one to date, but it's
pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
And again, it was total by chance.
Yeah.
The whole gallery is all, every show we've had has had not a bicycle theme to it, but behind it.
Ah.
So every artist that we've had show work has some connection to the bike industry. Be it they work at a shop, they work for a company, they are a company, and this is their hobby. But Carolyn Yang's show is, she was hired by Giant to go shoot the tour, the 2004 tour, and she lives in St. Paul.
Oh.
Who would have known?
Nice.
And she came in because she had heard through the grapevine that, hey, there's this gallery over in Minneapolis, and there's a bike shop, blah, blah, blah. And she came in, and we're like, oh, what do you know? So, and we had like 300 people show up for the opening, and it's been really, really positive.
Oh, yeah.
Versus the some of the other shows we had, which didn't have a core bike bent to the images.
Okay.
Two shows we did have, but not with the feedback or the what people are saying is, you know, it's obvious it's going to be far more positive because of what they're looking at. So it's really cool. We're going to leave it up. It's going to have an extended show here.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's nice.
And we're going to probably do some straight up bike shows.
Okay.
Kind of like fashion, because certain elements of the bicycle have the design, the execution of the design, or just how it looks. People have they have a feeling for that.
Yeah.
And that'll be the next thing. So end of February is when we'll change it out. Nice. I do have a comic or an illustration show coming up after that with Roger Lutine, Andy Singer, and Roadkill Bill, which are all local. They're all local illustrators that have anti-carb bent.
Right.
All their subjects ride bicycles. And it's illustrated cartoon style, so that'll be really fun. And of course, those guys are all local too. So the culture in Minneapolis is it's so deep and so broad.
Yeah.
We truly are, we're kind of a major player in the industry now. Not the shop, but the culture in Minneapolis as a whole.
It's
seems
huge.
To be more than, I mean, we have a lot of players. We've got an unnamed large company over in Waterloo, Wisconsin that owns like five brands.
Right.
We've got SRAM down in Chicago. We have Quality Bicycle Products, which is some people consider the largest distributor in the country.
Okay.
The oldest distributor in the country is Island Cycle, which is now owned by J&B. They're right down the street. Rivendale, which is a really special, we'd say high-end niche builder. He's out of California, but his builder's here in Minneapolis.
Okay.
We've got another handful of frame builders that are, I would say, nationally known here. One of the biggest and the best cycling clubs in the country is here. The oldest cycling club in the country is based here.
Really? Which one's that?
It's the Gopher Wheelman.
Oh, okay.
And not that we produce like tons of world-class riders, but produce a lot of world-class culture.
Absolutely.
And it's that a lot of people are like, what? Right. I thought it was all in California. And it's like, there's a segment there, and there's a segment on the East Coast, and then there's here, which we call the Mid-Coast. So, you know, if I had my way, I'd have containers of bikes coming into Duluth Harbor instead of L.A. or New York. So,
you got some great looking bikes here. I mean, you've been able to pull in Bianchi and
great
Surly
brand.
Yeah,
Surly's homegrown.
Yeah,
not made here, but everything about the company is here, and all the testing and the research and development. You could say we're all ex Surly employees.
Okay.
I'm an ex-Salsa employee.
Ah, okay.
Short term.
Right.
Didn't last very long. and we're sticking with Bianchi because it's a marquee brand.
Absolutely.
It's 120 years old. Surly, much more like working class.
Mm-hmm.
Not cheap, but cheap enough for most people.
Yeah.
And that's it. We're not really going to diversify into like having six lines because you don't go into a BMW dealership to buy a Ford. And
exactly.
It's like, why does the bike industry do that?
So the only place I'm going to be able to find a Huffy in your shop is probably in the junkyard, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and in the junkyard, there's pretty much every single brand probably made in the last 30 years now.
Uh-huh.
It's not a lot of stuff, but there's enough down there to, mm-hmm. if you really want to do it, you can probably find it down there.
Right.
I think. And if not, I've got some sources. My mentor, Evan Hatcher at Hatcher Cycle in Rockford, was he's the one who got me in the bike business.
Nice.
So, and he knows all.
Great.
Besides my mechanic.
Yeah.
Who knows, I think, more than anybody in the city.
Excellent. Thanks for talking with me today, Jane.
My pleasure.
Anything else you want to throw in? Anything else you want to plug?
Just keep riding.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Have a good weekend. I'll let you know when it's up. Give it a listen.
Yeah.
All right. That's it.
So what did we have? How many minutes?
Oh, boy. I don't know. It might even be...
Eight?
It might be like an hour and some change.
An hour?
Let's see.
No, we didn't talk for an hour.
No, half hour. About half hour.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. All right. Thanks for listening, folks. You got a little under a half hour, I suspect. And so drop your email comments to firstcrack@garrickvanburen.com or your audio comments at 206-20-BEAN-1. That's right, folks. We've got a new phone number. It's 206-20-BEAN-1. Talk to you later.